doing a PhD in linguistics.
Yeah. 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 Ola.
He's lovely. I met him. He's a delightful man. He met Emir today. He's met Emir at the Royal Society.
I don't know whether I did hear about that.
T-shirt made. Thank you very much.
A photograph of you and Bernie on the front with a gun target on. He was so
That's unbelievable.
Such an odd.
It's just. It can't be right, because if it is, then.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
well, then the consequences are unthinkable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We can't possibly allow.
Yeah, yeah. It's really nice to meet you. I've heard about you for years, and I'm just thrilled. Okay. I guess I have to turn it on.
Lovely. We have the last few arriving, hopefully. Good evening, and welcome to the Round Church. My name is Kevin Moss. I'm on the board of Christian Heritage here at the Round Church. And a very warm welcome to this evening, which is intended as an informal scene setter, an opportunity for you to meet the speakers who are going to be speaking to us tomorrow at the conference in Hughes Hall. Let me give you a few notes about the running order for tonight. We're going to try and keep very tightly to the following times. Professor Steve Mayer is going to be on his feet giving you his overview in a couple of minutes' time at 7:05. He's going to run through to about 7:25, whereupon hopefully the pizzas will have arrived. And we will then disperse and feed in a frenzied manner. There's drinks to the right, there'll be pizzas over to the left, and hopefully sufficient pizzas for all of us. If you need the toilets or WCs or whatever terminology you wish to use, they're over there on the right through the door in the corner. We would aim to finish at 9 this evening. After the pizza and refreshment bits, we will mingle and network until 8:10. And at 8:10, please promptly back for Q&A. And our speakers will be at the front forming a panel, and you'll have an opportunity to ask questions. There will be no roving mic, as it has just given up the ghost, so you'll have to speak up nice and loud when that happens. So thank you very much. Work with us keeping to time. Tonight is like a kind of gentle, informal refreshment, refresher exercise. Tomorrow, people who are late for sessions get taken out the back and are humanely shot. Tonight, we're a little bit more relaxed. So, Dr. Steve Mayer.
Very good. Okay. The debate about design in life and in the universe is an ancient debate, and it's also a Cambridge debate. I was just reflecting on the number of really seminal figures who have contributed to the debate who have been Cambridge people. The ancient part first. Right back to the ancient Greeks, there was the two strains of thought. One that saw that life was the product of some kind of mind, the Plato-Aristotle strain, and the other that thought that life was the product of some kind of undirected material process with no mind, the Democritus, the Atomists, and others. So this has been a part of human discourse and debate as long as people have thought philosophical thoughts. Is it mind over matter or matter producing mind in the broadest categories? Now, in the scientific revolution, the mind over matter view predominated. One of the watchwords of the scientific revolution was the idea that nature was intelligible. And the reason that the early modern scientists thought that nature was intelligible is they thought that the universe had been created by a rational God who had also created human beings with the gift of rationality that allowed them to perceive the rational order and design built into nature. So they not only presupposed that life had been designed and the universe had been designed, they also went out and looked and found additional evidence of that. So you had these wonderful design arguments that were built right right into the structure of some of the great works of science. Newton's Principia, in the General Scholium, he lays out this fine-tuning argument having to do with the delicate balance of the planets in their planetary orbit. In the optics, he makes a biological design argument based upon the unique fitness of the eye to perceive the different properties of light. Boyle, same design arguments. Kepler, we were, several of us, at the Royal Society conference this earlier in the week, and at the Royal Society have the great portraits of Boyle and Newton. Most of the participants in the conference were very much committed to the matter, undirected matter, material evolution view, and so in some ways historically ironic to have the great venerated pictures of Newton and Boyle there, and a very different perspective now predominating at the Royal Society. But this is the ancient debate, and of course what shifts after the scientific revolution. Later in the 19th century, you get the rise of a more materialistic philosophy of science and more materialistic theories of origins, which in fact give rise to this philosophy of science. And of course, Darwin is a seminal figure in this because he attempts to explain the origin of new living forms from pre-existing forms as a result of a purely unguided, undirected process, namely natural selection acting on random variation. And for him, you don't have design, but instead you have merely the appearance of design. And our friendly interlocutor, Richard Dawkins, has captured this idea in the very first page of The Blind Watchmaker, a very clarifying statement of the Darwinian view. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So you have this shift in the late 19th century away from actual design in nature, pointing to an actual designing intelligence, to the idea of the mere appearance of design, pointing to an undirected process that can mimic the powers of a designing intelligence. And the attribute or the appearance of design that the 19th century biologists were focused on was adaptation. In the 20th and 21st century, there have been some other things that have come into the fore, and there's a big question now in biology, in evolutionary biology, this is what many of us witnessed to this week, about whether, if we think about things other than minor, the ability of organisms to adapt to their environment in very minor ways, whether there might still be features of living systems that can't be explained by these undirected, unguided processes, and therefore maybe perhaps we could be thinking about actual design again. In any case, the debate about design, I think, takes an interesting turn in this town, in this city in the 1950s. Watson and Crick elucidate the structure of DNA. They're not themselves sympathetic, either one of them, to the design hypothesis, although, interestingly, Crick, in World War II, was a code breaker. Think what he later did when he got working on molecular biology. I think he was thinking very much, bringing the framework of design reasoning to his work, though inadvertent. He was a materialist philosophically. We need to be clear on that. In any case, Watson and Crick elucidate the structure of the DNA molecule around the corner at the old Cavendish on Free School Lane. And that's 1953. 4 years later, Crick formulates what's known as the sequence hypothesis, which I think exceeded even the extraordinary insight that he brought to bear on cracking the structure, because he realizes that DNA is functioning as a true information storage molecule. It's carrying code in a digital form, and he postulates the idea that the chemical subunits along the interior of the famed double helix, the nucleotide bases, are each individually functioning as alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in a section of what we would think of now as machine code or software. In other words, he's thinking that those subunits are conveying information in virtue of their arrangement in accord with an independent code. And he already by 1957 is anticipating that this has something to do with protein synthesis, and it's just an extraordinary burst of insight. And it takes a number of years 5 to 7 years, depending on which experiments you count as most crucial, for his sequence hypothesis to be confirmed. This is the period of time that historians refer to as the molecular biological revolution. It's a flurry of activity on two sides of the Atlantic, but it turns out that he is largely correct, that the DNA is encoding information in a digital form. That digital information is necessary for building the proteins and protein machines that allow cells to stay alive. Now, at first, this discovery is cast as confirmation of the Darwinian undirected materialistic account of origins, because initially it allows evolutionary biologists to think that we now understand more about the mechanism of mutation, or the mechanism of, more broadly speaking, variation. A mutation, then, it's thought, after the Watson-Crick discovery, a mutation would be a change in the arrangement of those nucleotide bases that are conveying the information in a digital or alphabetic or typographic form. So that seems to help at first with understanding more about what by this time is called the neo-Darwinian mechanism, where it's not natural selection acting on random variations, it's natural selection acting on random mutations, and the mutations are chance variations or chance changes in the arrangement of these information-bearing subunits in DNA, the bases, the nucleotide bases. So far, so good. Mid-1960s, some high-powered math, physics, computer science professors at MIT are having a picnic with their biology colleagues, and they start asking them some probing questions. If DNA is storing information in a typographic or digital form, and it's crucial to building proteins, which are highly complex structures, the function of which is necessary to living, sustaining viability of all living organisms, how likely is it that random changes in those digital, in those chemical subunits functioning as digital characters are going to result in anything truly beneficial or novel? And a number of these people are sensitive to issues in coding and cryptographic concerns, and they're computer people, and they're realizing if you start changing a computer program at random, and there was someone who made this point from the floor at the Royal Society meeting. He says, I'm a computer design engineer, and I know that if I have a software program and I start changing the zeros and ones at random, I'm not going to get anything new that's valuable. And I often ask audiences, especially if there's programmers in the audience, if you have a functioning computer program and you start changing the zeros and ones at random, are you more likely to generate a new software program or operating system, or degrade the information that you have? Or even more precisely, will you degrade information before you ever get to the new operating system or computer? And, you know, programmers typically laugh when I pose the hypothetical question. So this was the problem that the mathematically inclined scientists from MIT and some others, some really high-powered people, a French mathematician, Marcel Schussenberger, one of the inventors of the hydrogen bomb, Ulam, the great physicist, they were deeply skeptical for mathematical reasons, because they knew in any system, any true coding system, the ways of arranging the characters that will give you a functional communication outcome are extremely rare in comparison to the number of ways there are to arrange things that will go wrong, that will give you gibberish. And that's just inherent in the logic of a communication system. And so they were skeptical. The issue was left for a time. They wrote up the proceedings. The biologist said, well, maybe it's not quite so bad. Maybe in biology there's a lot of ways that could give you function, and so that the mutation mechanism could move from one island of function to the next kind of readily. Anyway, you move the clock forward. One of our colleagues here tonight, Doug Axe, actually did about a dozen years of research here at Cambridge University to answer that question about how rare the functional sequences are in this, what they call the space of possibilities. And it turns out they're rare exponentially beyond anyone's imagination. It's very difficult for the natural selection random mutation mechanism to hopscotch or skip from one little plateau of function to another. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow. But all that to say, this discovery of the information-bearing properties of DNA, when analyzed mathematically, and now empirically as well, has raised some really profound questions about the adequacy of the neo-Darwinian mechanism, some of which were acknowledged at this meeting at the Royal Society this last week. I first became aware of what you might call the information problem in the mid-1980s. I was working as a geophysicist for an oil company. I was doing digital signal processing, which was an early form of information technology. And I met a scientist named Charles Thaxton who had written a book called The Mystery of Life's Origin. And as difficult as the problem of the origin of new information was turning out to be in the field of biological evolution, where biological evolution is concerned with the origin of new forms of life from simpler pre-existing forms, the problem of the origin of information was even more acute for scientists who are working in chemical evolutionary theory, which is the branch of evolutionary theory which is concerned with the origin of the very first life from simpler non-living chemicals. And for one thing, natural selection isn't the same kind of factor there. If you don't have organisms that can self-replicate, it's hard to understand how natural selection would play a role. There's other chemical factors. It turned out to be very difficult to get from chemistry to code, especially code in a nicely formed molecule. And the professor, Dr. Thaxton, and two colleagues, Walter Bradley and a geochemist named Roger Olson, wrote this seminal book. It was published in 1984. I met them at a conference in 1985. I was fascinated with their ideas. It was a comprehensive critique of all the various theories of chemical evolution or evolutionary abiogenesis. I think Alexander Oparin, Haldane, the early guys who were forming these origin of life theories, how you get from the chemistry in the prebiotic soup, Stanley Miller, we'll talk more about all this later. And they wrote this comprehensive critique, but their most powerful critique had to do with the difficulty of forming information from undirected, unguided processes. And they critiqued the various attempts that had been made to do this, but at the end of the book, they published a kind of outside-the-box, edgy epilogue in which they suggested a hypothesis that they didn't really have a name for at the time. They called it the idea of an intelligent cause. They suggested maybe an intelligent cause had been involved in the production of the information, because intuitively said information is the kind of thing we know from experience is a mind product. It's something that's produced by agents or intelligent beings with minds or conscious and rational agents. It's not produced by chemistry. Chemistry produces crystals, maybe. It nicely ordered structures. It does not produce information. And so they suggested that maybe we ought to consider this. And that, so through a variety of circumstances, I met Charles Thaxton. I began to talk to him about his controversial idea. In 1986, having spent about a year just getting to know him better, I was off to Cambridge to do what I thought was going to be a one-year master's. And I ended up doing some work on the origin of life problem. And I had this question in the back of my mind, could this intuitive connection between information and the prior activity of a mind be developed into a formal argument for design, a scientifically rigorous argument for design? And I ended up staying on here at Cambridge to do a PhD. Ironically, I began to get some answers to my questions by studying the work of Charles Darwin and not just his theories about the origin of new forms of life, but his method of reasoning about the ancient past, because Darwin, following his mentor Charles Lyell, had pioneered a method of historical scientific reasoning where they were able to discern causes for events in the remote past by analyzing the clues that were left behind. It was reasoning backwards in time or retrodictively or sometimes called abductively. And so I ended up doing my PhD thesis on this style of historical scientific reasoning. It turned out they were using a method that one of the people in my department, Peter Lipton, called inference to the best explanation, where you look at the evidence, you generate competing hypotheses, and then you ask yourself, which one best explains the evidence? And that raised a crucial question, which is, well, what makes an explanation best? It turned out Lipton had a way of answering that question that was very consistent with the way Darwin and Lyell answered it. And the answer, in short, was this: the best explanation is the explanation for an event in the remote past is a cause which is known to produce the effect in question. Lyell called it a cause now in operation. Example, I did my undergraduate degree in Washington State. In eastern Washington, there's a white powdery substance that you can still see clustered in various places around the wheat fields. And if you weren't in Washington State on May 18th, 1980, when there was a dramatic geological event, you would have to use this method of multiple competing hypotheses. What caused the ash to get, the white stuff to get there? Was it a flood? Was it a rainstorm? Was it a earthquake? Was it a volcanic eruption? Which of those hypotheses is best according to Lyell and Darwin's criterion? Well, it's the volcanic eruption, because we know, we have uniform and repeated experience of volcanoes producing white powdery stuff. Floods and earthquakes don't do that. So there's a test of experience as we're making hypotheses about causes in the remote past. And again, Lyell's phrase was, we should be looking for causes now in operation, causes that we have seen producing the effect in question. And one day as I was thinking about this, the nickel dropped, because I was thinking about the problem of the origin of information and how difficult it had been to solve in both branches of evolutionary theory. And I said, and I came across a passage in a book on the early application of information theory to molecular biology, or it was an early book on the application of information theory to molecular biology, written by a man named Henry Quassler. And he said, in just an offhand passage, he says, the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. Our uniform and repeated experience tells us that information always comes from a conscious, rational agent. And I realized that by using the method of Darwin and Lyell, I could actually form a rigorous scientific argument for intelligent design. Using their method pointed to intelligent design as the best explanation for the origin of information, including the information that was present in all living cells stored in the DNA molecule, and now we know in other places as well. So that's a brief sketch of the argument and my story and how I came to the conclusion that it was possible to make a strong case for the theory of intelligent design. I've written two fat books, Signature in the Cell, which is about the problem of the origin of the information necessary to build the first life, and Darwin's Doubt, which is about the nature or the origin of the information necessary to build new forms of life, in particular the animal forms that arise in an event called the Cambrian Explosion. We're going to be talking in the conference tomorrow about a whole various facets of this argument and of the case for intelligent design and the philosophical objections, the scientific alternatives, and we're going to have a panel of just terrific scientists in paleontology, molecular biology, genomics, biochemistry, a variety of subjects, and some philosophers too that will be addressing the status of this argument. In just the last few minutes I have before we go get the pizza, I wanted to just give you a little bit of an update on how what I've just been talking about relates to what is really an extraordinary development in evolutionary biology. I wrote about this in my book Darwin's Doubt, but the status of evolutionary theory, the scientific status, is being challenged within evolutionary biology itself. It's kind of hard to say evolutionary biologists are challenging evolutionary theory, but there is an orthodox theory of evolutionary biology known as neo-Darwinism, the idea that natural selection is acting on the random mutations. And the random mutations are thought to be the source, the engine of variability. But for some of the reasons I've already discussed and other reasons, mainstream evolutionary biologists are saying this theory does not work. We need a new theory. There's a group called the Altenburg 16, another group, they sometimes call themselves the Third Way, others who are talking about the need for an extended synthesis, and they really formed this conference at the Royal Society where criticism and critical evaluation of the received theory that we all learn in our biology textbooks was under scrutiny and challenge. And so there were different factions in that conference. But what was interesting to us is on the first day, one of the leading theoretical biologists in the world, Gerd Müller, laid out a number of unsolved problems that have been unsolved by neo-Darwinism, one of which is the origin of novel, that is new, phenotypic body, roughly, traits, the new. And the other is the problem of what he called in a book that he'd written, the problem of organismal form. So the individual traits that animals have and their large-scale organization, or sometimes called their body plans. And when I first saw the book where he laid this out, I thought it was extraordinary, because the question that Darwin most importantly was addressing and attempting to answer was the origin of form. Where does the origin of biological form come from? And this question of the origin of traits, we know in biology, it's kind of like in computer science. If you want to give your computer a new function, you've got to give it new code, right? So same thing in biology. You want to build a new trait, a new feature or structure, you've got to have the information for building the proteins out of which that trait is made. So essentially, Professor Mueller was saying, we don't have an explanation for the origin of information or the origin of new traits and the information necessary to build it, and we don't have an explanation for the origin of the overall organization of animals, plants and animals, but especially animals. So the most important questions that Darwinism sought to answer in 1859 are now in the perspective of many leading evolutionary biologists unanswered, which makes this a very interesting time to reopen this discussion. And it's into that milieu that we're offering the theory of intelligent design as a contending idea, and one which we think has a lot to offer, both as an explanation for key attributes of living systems, but also as a guide to future discovery. Good theories not only provide explanations of facts we have already, they illuminate research questions, generate predictions, and help us look forward in science, come up with new ideas. Sometimes they help us get to good ideas faster. So tomorrow we're going to talk both about the explanatory power of the theory of intelligent design and its heuristic value. And under the heading of, what are we calling this, Paul? It's the Beyond Materialism, Science for the 20th Century, Biology for the 21st Century. We think intelligent design underwrites a robust scientific research program, and we want to talk to you about how that plays out in a number of disciplines. So that's what we're going to do, and that's... I finished 1 minute early. I never do that. So that's where we're coming from. And I suppose one other aspect of this is, obviously, when we talk about intelligent design, this is we're challenging a strictly materialistic view of biological and cosmological origins. Remember I said the two ancient views all the way back to the Greeks? One was undirected matter produces the complexity we see in life and the universe. The other view is that mind is somehow shaping the matter, or did so in the past to produce the complexity we see. Two different views. One of the interesting dynamics of the debate that we're in is that the rules of science have been understood since the late 19th century to exclude the mind-shaping matter view of things. And so there's the understanding now that if you're a real scientist, you have to limit yourself to strictly materialistic explanations, regardless of what the phenomenon is that you might be looking at. If you go into the British Museum, you see the Rosetta Stone. If you're stuck in a strictly materialistic methodology, you're going to have to say, well, I guess it was wind and erosion, even though you know full well that you're not going to get all those nice information-rich inscriptions without an intelligent agent playing a role. And that's a little of the situation we see biology and cosmology in, is that there are good reasons, because of the nature of the phenomenon, to consider intelligent or rational causation, but the rules of science as they're presently understood are excluding that possibility from consideration. Thus, the idea of intelligent design is a little bit, as we were told today, a curse word, or it's toxic, or it's very controversial. But part of our program is not only to show the empirical evidence for it and why it provides a better explanation for some of the key features of life, but we're also challenging the rules of science that forbid us from considering the design hypothesis as a legitimate explanation for the things we see in the natural world. So I'll stop there. Yep. And there's pizza.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So now it's your opportunity. There is pizza. It's coming in dribs and drabs, not all in one great, vast onslaught of cheesy comestibles, which is what we'd hope would happen. But there we are. It's coming. And there are drinks over to the right. Could I ask the Discovery team to stand briefly so that the rest of you guys know who they are? So these are the people to talk to. you've got an opportunity tonight, so bend their ears for all you're worth. So let's break, and we'll be back here for about 8:10, 8:15. Okay? Thank you very much. And it's serve yourselves, I'm afraid, folks. There's plates and there's pizzas.